ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 22nd of April. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. US President Donald Trump says he will extend the ceasefire with Iran just hours from its scheduled end, despite no progress on negotiations for peace talks. In a social media post, Mr. Trump says he will hold off attacking Iran until Tehran's negotiating teams come up with a unified proposal for a peace agreement. Correspondent Rachel Clayton is in Washington, D.C. Rachel, President Trump says the ceasefire is being extended. What are the details?
That's right. So there'd been significant uncertainty for the past few hours about whether these peace talks were going to go ahead to extend this ceasefire. We've now heard from the president on social media who says the US is going to hold off its attacks on Iran and that this ceasefire will continue to give Iran more time to come up with a proposal for a peace plan. So he said on Truth Social that based on the fact the government of Iran is what he calls seriously fractured, and because he'd been requested by Pakistani officials, including the Prime Minister, who asked the US to hold off its attack on the country of Iran until, as he says, until such time as their leaders and representatives can come up with a unified proposal. He goes on and says that he's directed the military to continue the blockade of Iranian ports, but to also extend the ceasefire until the proposal is submitted. So it's interesting that he's extending the ceasefire because days ago he told Bloomberg that he was definitely not going to extend the ceasefire, that if the talks failed, he was ready to bomb Iran. He said as early as this morning to CNBC that the military was gearing up to continue the fight. This is now a complete 180 where he said that the ceasefire will continue and he won't attack Iran. And it really, I think, shows not just how fluid the situation is and how quickly things can change, but the pressure that these Pakistani leaders and officials are under to make sure that the fighting does not continue. They've been under significant pressure to ask Washington to make some concessions to get Iran to the table. That hasn't worked. One of the main things was that blockade. Iran wanted that blockade of its ports lifted. Washington was unwilling to do that. And in this post, we've heard from the president saying that that blockade will continue, but that the ceasefire will also continue. So it seems to have worked. The pressure the Pakistani leaders have been putting on Washington has worked, and the talks will go ahead, it seems, just a little later than when we were expecting.
But as you say, the blockade continuing, and we still have action from the US Navy. They've boarded another ship as part of this blockade. So what do we know about that?
That's right. So this happened overnight in the US. It was a tanker that was allegedly carrying sanctioned Iranian oil towards Singapore, flying the flag of Botswana, allegedly part of Iran's shadow fleet that we've heard quite a bit about from General Dan Kane. He calls it a dog fleet. And it was boarded. It's been taken over by the United States. What happens to it now is a bit unknown. It will be handed over to the Coast Guard. And I've been told that there'll be discussions with various countries around the Bay of Bengal in South Asia where the tanker was seized to decide what to do with the oil on board. The other development that's happened today is that the Treasury Department has announced new sanctions on 14 people and aircraft from Iran, the UAE and Turkey that the US says are helping Iran obtain weapons or parts of weapons. So the pressure from the United States on Iran has continued all day, and now it's culminated in this extension of the ceasefire, which is giving everyone a bit more breathing room.
Rachel Clayton in Washington, D.C. And Iran has responded to the latest announcement by President Trump. A spokesman has said the ceasefire extension is a ploy to buy time for a surprise attack by the U.S. Back home, the federal government is set to announce major reforms to the $50 billion National Disability Insurance Scheme today, when the minister in charge of the program, Mark Butler, gives a speech at the National Press Club. Changes such as mandatory registration of providers, altering pricing rules, and tightening of certain types of support have all been under consideration. For more, I was joined earlier by our National Disability Affairs reporter, Naz Campanella. Naz, why is today's speech so important?
Well, today is a really hotly anticipated speech purely because a lot of the talk in the recent years about the NDIS has been about its cost. So in its original projections, the Productivity Commission said that in its maturity, the NDIS would support about 400,000 participants, and that has now swelled to 760,000 participants, and it's now costing $50 billion, so more than Medicare and edging pretty close to defence spending as well. Now, the government has had a target of 10%, and it has said in recent time that it is on track to meet that target, but it is now going to be talking about plans to reach a 5% target, and how they will achieve that is what will be unveiled today.
So can you talk me through some of the things that are likely to be the key areas of focus if the government is looking to try and further constrain the growth of the NDIS?
Well, I have to say the government has been really tight-lipped about what this is. So it's all predictions from me and from conversations with many people. But I think the really key things is firstly mandatory registration. So it is voluntary for many organisations and providers to be registered. It is not illegal to operate as an NDIS provider unregistered, but some providers, particularly in accommodation and sort of platform providers which connect participants with support workers, will have to be registered by July 1st. That was recently announced. And my feeling is that that will go even further today. Another big thing is what to do with groups outside of the NDIS. And one in particular is people with psychosocial disability. There are about 65,000 of them on the NDIS, but hundreds of thousands still outside the scheme who require support. So what will be done across the states and territories really to support those people? And finally, it's pricing, Mel. There's it's described as a flat pricing structure at the moment. So you could be a support worker going in and providing, for example, you know, showering, feeding, or you could be a nurse that goes in and supports someone to have medication or a feeding tube, and the prices are very similar. So people talking about looking at prices of therapies, who can get them, how frequently they can get them, and also looking at, I guess, the price of services according to quality. So maybe perhaps a tiered approach. So that'll be really interesting to see what happens there.
So depending on what the government announces today, there could be some big changes coming. What's the feeling in the community?
Yeah, it's safe to say the changes will be big. And the feeling in the community, to put it in a word, is anxiety. I know of one particular group that ran an online town hall last night for people to try and quell concerns, have a bit of a sit down with everyone and have a chat and just kind of say, you know, we're all in this together. But, you know, I've heard weekly for years now about people having cuts to plans, being very concerned that they have significant permanent disability and feeling like a lot of their services are being cut. Everyone has consensus that something needs to change. The trajectory of the scheme cannot continue this way because the community wants this scheme to last into the future for generations. So there's consensus on that. It's how the reforms are done that the community is concerned about. They want it done with transparency and proper communication.
Naz Campanella there. Hundreds of parents are already dealing with the impact of earlier changes to the NDIS aimed at reining in its growing costs. A key provider of specialised childcare centres for autistic children, the AEIOU Foundation, went into liquidation last month. The abrupt closure of its 11 sites followed cuts to plans for NDIS recipients. Emma Pollard reports.
Hands on the steering wheel.
In the garden of a brick home north of Brisbane, 5-year-old Dimitri plays with a toy car alongside his father. When he was 2, Dimitri was diagnosed with the most severe level of autism. He didn't speak or interact with people. Single dad Eric Moore, who's a teacher, says Dimitri had to leave 3 mainstream childcare centres.
They asked me to find somewhere else for him because they couldn't manage him.
Then, early last year, he started at an AEIOU centre, which provided autistic children with high support needs with daycare and therapies under one safe roof. Dimitri was making steady progress.
He started being more expressive of his needs and what he wanted. We started learning some basic basic ways to communicate back and forth. His understanding vastly improved.
But last month, their lives were turned upside down when the AEIOU Foundation went into liquidation. All 11 centres in Queensland, Adelaide and Canberra telling hundreds of parents like Eric not to return.
We're closed. We no longer have jobs. We're shut down. Don't bring him back tomorrow. So I initially had to take time off work to care for him during the day while we start trying to piece everything back together.
For 20 years, AEIOU provided thousands of autistic children with early intervention services. Devastated parents and staff blame NDIS cuts for its demise. Cancer doctor James Morton started the foundation after his own son's autism diagnosis and was on the board.
And in 2024, suddenly packages got dramatically cut. So from 6 hours of therapy, which they were funded at the time, down to 2 hours of therapy. And parents were told that they had to have their children in mainstream or look after them at home.
Canberra-based Dr. Martin Laverty helped design and implement the NDIS and now heads a disability service. He says the AEIOU Foundation likely won't be the last to fold.
Right around the country, we are seeing therapy providers who have faced a seven-year freeze in the therapy price, fighting viability challenges to survive.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the NDIS Minister, Jenny McAllister, says the scheme funds individual supports in line with the child's assessed needs, not entire programs designed by providers. Griffith University autism researcher Jessica Painter previously worked for AEIOU. The associate professor says benchmarking shows the centres had positive outcomes and their closure is unacceptable.
By cutting funds for one place, such as NDIS, we're only going to increase costs in other places, such as mental health, emergency wards or education settings.
The agency running the NDIS says it has worked closely with families affected by the closures to assist children to transition to alternative services. Dimitri's dad says his son's behaviour deteriorated after his centre shut. He's since enrolled the five-year-old in a special school, an option not open to parents with younger children.
It is grossly unfair because it is the children, ultimately, who suffer.
Queensland father Eric Moore, ending that report by Emma Pollard. The leadership of UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer is under pressure as the fallout over the appointment and subsequent sacking of Peter Mandelson as ambassador to Washington widens. A senior civil servant was blamed and fired for not informing the Prime Minister Mandelson had failed to pass security vetting. But the controversy has emboldened critics of Keir Starmer, who was already under political pressure. Stephanie Smale reports.
The probe into how Labor power broker Peter Mandelson was appointed the British ambassador to the US despite concerns about his past continues. And the now former Foreign Office boss says there was pressure to make it happen, coming from the top.
I'm afraid I walked into a situation in which there was already a very, very strong expectation coming from Number 10 that he needed to be in post and in America as quickly as humanly possible.
Sir Ollie Robbins was sacked last week after it emerged his department had granted Lord Mandelson security clearance in January 2025. Lord Mandelson formally took up the role the following month, but was sacked 7 months later over his ties to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Sir Ollie has told the UK Parliament Number 10 Downing Street wanted Peter Mandelson in the post, but before Donald Trump's inauguration.
So I'm afraid what that translated into for my team in the Foreign Office and certainly the handover briefing I was getting as I arrived at post was what I felt was a generally dismissive attitude to his vetting clearance. The focus was on getting Mandelson out to Washington quickly.
Sir Ollie has pointed out that regardless of that pressure, his department completed the vetting process to the normal high standard. He explains Lord Mandelson was considered a borderline case and officials were leaning towards denying clearance, but the Foreign Office Security Department ruled that the risks could be managed or mitigated.
I was also told that the risks did not relate to Mandelson's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, and that I was told that UKSV acknowledged, I don't know in what way, but acknowledged that the Foreign Office might wish to grant clearance with appropriate risk management.
Sir Keir Starmer says even after Peter Mandelson was sacked over new revelations about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, he was not told about the vetting results. But the Prime Minister's judgment is under scrutiny after backing a man with a troubled and colourful past with public links to China, Russia and Epstein. In response to Conservative MP Afra Brandeth, Sir Ollie Robbins has echoed questions about Sir Keir's judgment.
I regret that this process was not done before announcement. I regret that due diligence process, which threw up, as I understand it, serious reputational risks, didn't colour the Prime Minister's judgment in making the appointment.
The full political impact from the Washington appointment, particularly on Sir Keir Starmer, is still unclear. Former adviser to UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, John McTernan, doubts he will be dumped as leader yet, but says his party will take a hit.
But the appointment was the terrible mistake. The appointment was the original sin, and the Labour Party is going to be punished badly at the polls in May for that.
Former Prime Ministerial Advisor John McTernan ending that report by Stephanie Smale. Back home, older Australians getting at-home support will no longer have to pay for showering from October in a major backdown by the federal government. Just 6 months in, it's dumping a controversial co-contribution decision that saw some older Australians paying $50 an hour out of pocket for basic care like showering. Political reporter Evelyn Manfield has more.
Basic care like showering should never have been treated like optional extras.
With advocates and providers aligned, the government has been under pressure for months to reverse its decision to charge at-home aged care recipients for basic services like showers. Corey Earlham from the Council on the Aging says the government's decision to now stop that come October is welcome but overdue.
This is about dignity. No one should have to choose between affordability and basic personal care.
Because of the new fee structure as part of the aged care reforms that passed Parliament in 2024 and took effect in November, the hourly cost providers charge has shot up. It's meant elderly folk on support at home packages have been paying between 5 and 50% of the fee of certain supports, which Samantha Edmund from the Older Persons Advocacy Network says has equaled big out-of-pocket costs.
From $50 upwards for showering in particular, certainly unreasonable prices. Some other older people, you know, might have only been having a shower once or twice a week.
Tom Simonson from Ageing Australia, which represents providers, is also backing the move.
It's a common sense, human rights-based decision to hopefully rebuild a bit of trust in the reforms that came in on the 1st of November.
With such widespread support, it begs the question why showers weren't fully covered in the first place. Well, Tom Simonson was also on the task force that reviewed the funding of aged care.
Providing fee-free or contribution-free services has a cost. The government has to pay the full price of those services through aged care packages, and they had wanted to make the aged care budget more manageable into the future.
The backflip just 6 months into the scheme will be officially announced by Health Minister Mark Butler during a speech at the National Press Club today, where he'll also unveil the government's plans to curb the cost of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, with some of those savings, as the government calls them, to be directed to aged care. It's not yet clear how much this aged care announcement will cost, but it's expected to be north of $1 billion. The spending demands don't stop there, though. Ahead of the federal budget, providers and advocates are once again united in a push for the government to fund more support at home packages to help reduce the wait list and wait times.
The government has to release more packages. We know that we've got 200 plus thousand people waiting either for an assessment or after they've had their assessment for the care to come.
Ageing Australia's Tom Simonson, ending that report by Evelyn Manfield. And that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump went into the war with Iran thinking it would be over quickly. Now, more than 7 weeks later, with a ceasefire about to end, there's still no obvious off-ramp. Today, a former Iran negotiator in the Trump administration, Nate Swanson, on what the US president needs to do to end the war. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.